And welcome back to the Book on Fire podcast. We gave a pretty lengthy intro last week, so I don't think we have a lot to share today. But we do have a little bit to wrap up from Chapter 8, Imaginary Cities, before we move on to the next chapter. So we're going to dive right into that.
Yeah, it turned out we had kind of a lot to say about the Ukrainian sites, the big cities, rounded cities. And then Uruk, and then the schismogenetic backlash, if you want to call it that. But there's two more case studies that pop up in this chapter before Chapter 8 is done. And let's touch on them quickly before we go on to Chapter 9. The first has to do with the Indus Valley city of Mohenjo-Daro. Mohenjo-Daro was established on the banks of the Indus River in about 2600 BC. Is that right? And it's located in what's now Pakistan. The Indus Valley was the home to South Asia's first urban culture. And they want to talk about Mohenjo-Daro because it contains some features that don't really compute into the standard calculus of the way a city is supposed to form according to the conventional idea of that. Archaeologists are working from what seems like not the best evidence about the early stages of Mohenjo-Daro because a lot of it was excavated in a more
fast and loose.
Yeah, like a less careful era of archaeology where a lot of the site was disrupted and kind of made a mess of in the early stages of the archaeological dig. And so that has obscured some of what we can know about the early stages. And then also, even though the Indus civilization had writing, that writing has not been deciphered. So that's like a big...
Yeah, that's big.
Opacity, you know, in being able to look at this stuff.
There was no Rosetta Stone that tied in the Indus language.
I guess not. But still, the picture that they are able to draw here of Mohenjo-Daro is of a city hierarchically organized, at least like materially. Like I think there's literally a hill at the center of the city. And crowning that hill is not like a government palace or, you know, the home of a monarch or like anything like that, but it is a great bath, a public bath. The bath was contained in the upper citadel, where it was kind of a part of the city unto itself, where there were people who maybe even lived in there who were kind of like the keepers of the bath, let's say. And it was a different, apparently like a different kind of stratum of society. But even all by itself, this the existence of the Great Bath as kind of the pinnacle of Mohenjo-Daro is interesting, at least because, you know, it's a public works project, right? It was a public bath. And then surrounding the upper citadel is like a district where maybe the merchants resided. And that's where you find palatial houses, when you find them at all, is in this kind of merchant's ring. And then there's some more parts of the city that are that don't even really exist anymore, but we can imagine that there was more rings kind of outside of that. And to be honest, for me, it's a little bit hard to follow what the Davids are making of all of this.
Yeah, definitely.
Because they come right out and say, like, maybe before I concluded this on my own, they come out and say, all of this is redolent of a caste system.
Right.
Basically. you know, they hedge around this a bit, especially in the footnotes, and say, like, now we shouldn't just project what we know of now. The caste system in India now all the way back to 2600 BC. But, you know, we can imagine that there were embryonic forms of the caste system that would evolve over time. The first time that you see it really laid out in writing is in the Vedas, which is like another 1,000 years into the future from this site, from the time period that they're talking about. So it's going to be 1,000 years before we see like the first hard evidence of the fully formed caste system, you know, but they talk about how it could be in keeping with the caste system for there to be, for the highest tier of society to be people who are most associated with like purification,
cleanliness,
and cleanliness and like the ascetic lifestyle. I actually don't know a lot about the ins and outs of the caste system in India.
Well, they do share a little bit on that was helpful in that it's, I think that we can associate caste and class so much that we can forget that in India and in the Vedic system that's described, that there is this association with cleanliness and purity. And those who have the least contact with the waste of the world, like physical waste from bodies.
Yeah, right.
But also like the waste of the world being like commerce, you know.
Right.
Those people are the Brahmin class would be the most removed from that.
Yeah. In like the idealized caste system, I think the way they're describing it here and what you're describing is that like the world renouncers are the highest.
Right.
So the ascetics. Yeah. Yeah. So they see something that they conclude is redolent of caste. Mm-hmm. And even though caste is clearly hierarchical, it's not hierarchical exactly in the way that we think of it in a more Western conception of politics, where the highest caste has the most political power and the most wealth and all the things. And so this seems to at least be like interesting to them, where they're like, yeah, there's hierarchy there. It's this caste hierarchy. But we actually don't know anything about how everyday affairs were organized. You know, because there's no like police barracks or whatever, there's no soldiers. The site is absent a lot of the conventional signs of power, like wielded through violence and wielded through coercion, you know? So it's like, they have to admit, yeah, there's hierarchy, but also there doesn't seem to be a lot of violence. And, you know, but also unlike Uruk, there doesn't seem to be any evidence of public assemblies or public deliberation or anything like that. But there's no evidence of monarchy either, you know? So they're just like stirring up maybes around all of this, like basically. And by their own admission, there's also more palatial houses next to the smaller ones, you know, in the next tier down. So there's definitely wealth disparities, but they're like, but we don't know how much that had to do with the day-to-day affairs. Yeah, like I don't disagree that Mohenjo-daro is interesting, you know, for all these reasons. It's like it didn't seem to have a monarch. It didn't seem to have standing armies. Like it didn't seem to have these like kind of cliched, you know, feature of like an empire or something. But what we can say about how power was wielded in the city, it doesn't seem like they have a lot. There's not a lot that they're like working with, really. And in fact, there are as many signs of hierarchy as there are signs of the other thing.
Yeah, I'm a bit unclear personally on why that was even stayed in the final version of the book. Except that I think the next part is pretty interesting.
It's interesting. I mean, it seems like an interesting site, and it does yield a new set of questions and like a new set of problems. Like if there's not this and this, then what was the nature of power?
I guess it is an example.
All of this. But it's harder to read egalitarianism into it than it is some of the others.
I guess it is an example of something they are trying to point out, which is that there are many ways society can look. And it's not the entire hierarchy package of centralized every power. Or the total egalitarian package that we might think of with modern notions of what that looks like, and that there's all kinds of versions in between that might have some shitty power dynamics, but not others, you know.
We can at least take that away from it.
Yes.
That there's like a lot of different combinations and permutations of organs of power, locations of power, violent versus not, or I mean, just all kinds of things. And like, here is another, you know, combination or permutation of like the possible that we don't know everything about. And so it does invite some questions. Before they leave South Asia, they have a paragraph where they just want to point out that there is a tradition of more or less democratic assembly in South Asia that we can locate in the Buddhist monasteries, the Sangha. They even say that the word Sangha was first used for popular assemblies that governed South Asian cities in the Buddha's lifetime. Mm-hmm. And that that word got like then adopted
by
the monasteries.
Yeah.
Monasteries historically have had like a diversity of
yes.
political power within them as far as hierarchy versus not. But it's been far from rare for them to be democratically governed by assemblies.
Right.
So there is a tradition there that we can point to. And then finally, they also have like a pretty interesting little example of a Balinese system called Seka, S-E-K-A. And they talk about how in Bali, the society is not only divided by caste, but there's also even finer grains of hierarchy, such that like in a formal sense, at least, no two people are equal. No two people are equal. So even like a lowly laborer has like a laborer who's under them and one that's just one step above, you know, right? And you, part of knowing who you are is knowing exactly where you fit in this pecking order in which no two people are equal. Yet, however, a lot of the affairs of everyday life and just kind of decisions about whatever, like road maintenance, repairs, like education, just all kinds of things, are decided in meetings where basically everybody has a say.
Right.
And there's not stark power differentials within these meetings. And so this is just a way of them pointing to something that they really want to remind us of a lot, which is that democratic self-governance can kind of coexist with a formal hierarchy. Because there's like lots of different imaginal spheres of life that people can inhabit simultaneously. And in one of them, someone is of low rank and it's like completely stratified. But in another, they're just in a room trying to solve common sense problems with other people. And it's no big deal for people of different ranks to participate in that, you know, right? And this is like something that people sometimes do. Like
yeah,
you see
I
this.
Yeah, I think that our... I don't know. I think that we just have such a strange legacy that's been so hamstrung by the versions of decision making that if you want to say democracy, but I don't think that's probably the right word. But yeah, in the way that we who live in what are called democratic societies, but we know what that actually looks like, which is we don't all get to have say. I think we can have certain associations with democracy or decision making that are... I don't know. We assume lack of access to decision making, even when we look at a lot of different groups, you know, or something. And so partially from our own experience, but even from studying Athenian democracy, which is that only, yes, some people got to have some say, but only if they were of equal rank or close to the same rank, you know? And so the idea that there might be a lot of folks from wildly different ranks making decisions together just feels very alien, you know? And this is part of what they're trying to point out. Like, our imagination is limited by that context, you know?
Yeah, our imagination is limited, you know? And I think part of what they want to tell us, too, is that especially when we're looking for models and different kinds of inspiration that we can learn from anthropology the world over and going back into history is to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Right.
Like, we can look at the Balinese system and be like, but they had this crazy hierarchy where it's a caste system and then it was hierarchical even within that and all of that. And that doesn't look good. But this other thing that they're doing right alongside that, that maybe has more practical import over their day-to-day life is something that we can be inspired by. The world is messy. Before we move on to the next thing, which is actually kind of a transition to what we're going to talk about in chapter 9, I just want to reflect a little bit on what they've done in this chapter so far, because they've thrown a lot at us, right? Examples of what might count as egalitarianism in the early history of cities. I just want to note also that they seem to have warmed up to the idea of egalitarianism.
That's true. That's true.
By this point of the book.
Once it's in cities, it's cooler.
Yeah. Because they spilled quite a bit of ink in the first few chapters, just sort of dashing.
Trashing it.
Egalitarianism as like a metric that would be mm-hmm. worth talking about or something. But here they find use for it.
Right.
Again. But they've shown us examples of places that achieved a very large scale.
Mm-hmm.
Large population, mm-hmm. large footprint on the earth without any formal signs of the state
mm-hmm.
existing.
Right.
Right. And that's important because they want to disprove this idea that scale by itself necessitates formalization of mm-hmm. power and hierarchy
right.
and things like that, basically. And I think that they do a pretty good job of that,
mm-hmm.
disproving the argument from scale. But, you know, I do just want to point out quickly that in the world of associating the rise of cities with the rise of states and empire and top-down power, scale is not the only thing that's on the table.
Right.
You know, if we look, I was just thinking this morning about as I was reviewing this stuff, that if we look at the theory that James Scott puts forward mm. in Against the Grain about how the earliest settlements in Mesopotamia that turned into city-states got started.
Mm-hmm.
In that theory, it's not that they got big to the point that they needed to become a state. It's that it had to do more with the concentration of the people.
Right.
People being very packed together and the material need to intensify agricultural production.
Mm-hmm.
In such a way that it made it possible for people to get control of the surplus in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
you know, and whether or not that's correct, it's at least another way of trying to think through
mm-hmm.
the growth of cities and them becoming hierarchical than just this very crude one that's just like large scale implies
means,
the state.
Right.
So, you know, if you really wanted to like address the thinking that is out there that associates urbanization with power, you know, then you need to go beyond the scale argument because
right.
that's not the only one that's there. They've also shown us in this chapter what we just talked about, which is that signs of formal hierarchy can conceal self-governance
right.
sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like in the Mesopotamian example, sometimes even cities that had a monarch,
mm-hmm.
the power seemed to have been wielded more so
right.
in the neighborhood assemblies.
Right.
You know? So they've shown us that. And kind of along with that is that especially early monarchy and statecraft
mm-hmm.
was particularly vulnerable and not particularly hegemonic.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So early statecraft was still developing and it was not perfected and it did not have necessarily a lot of power
mm-hmm.
over the territories that it claimed to control.
Right.
Right. And we'll see in the next couple of examples about how sometimes even that power could be overthrown.
Right. Yeah.
So we've learned a lot. One thing that I do want to point out that's kind of missing,
mm-hmm.
and we might come back to this, so I'm just going to say it quickly, but they have been looking particularly for the classical signs of state power. So formal bureaucracies, human sacrifice, signs of monarchy, all of this type of thing. But very little of their accounting in this chapter attempts to account for what you might call class power.
Right. That's true.
Which can look a lot of different ways,
mm-hmm.
but the way we think about it, I guess most often, and this is like the way that Marx analyzed it, would be like economic power.
Right.
Right. And you can have economic power over people because you benefit from their labor in a way that doesn't look like monarchy or even weaponry,
mm-hmm.
you know, and leave these kinds of traces. I mean, I imagine that it's probably hard to account for emerging class power. But I think one way of theorizing the state and class power is that like the organs of the state, like the police and bureaucracies and tribute and taxation and stuff,
yeah.
are just the formalization
mm-hmm.
and the codification of pre-existing class power.
Right.
And I just want to bring that in without like a whole lot of discussion about it, but just because I keep thinking there's lots of room mm-hmm. in these accounts that they're putting in for there to be that kind of power happening in these towns
mm-hmm.
emerging, and class power can be expressed in the neighborhood assemblies
right.
even. But class power can be expressed just in who has the power to steer economic and the subsistence activities of a town in mm-hmm. one direction or another.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's what capitalists do today. Mm-hmm. and that's like, I mean, you know, which is obviously a much further evolution of class power. But that's not to say that none of this exercise has been worth anything, mm-hmm. you know, obviously, because kind of like we were saying, we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to track
right.
the state of power and power over other people, I feel like we at least need to mention that economic power mm-hmm. is a major aspect of power.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily look like barracks mm-hmm. or bureaucracy or these things that the Davids are tracking so carefully.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. If you're not careful, if you're only looking at it through their analysis, it's kind of just like individual autonomy mm-hmm. and then state power mm-hmm. are our two factors that we're measuring all of the time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it's really important to remember all the other kinds of power.
Yeah.
And especially if what we're reading, the reason we're reading this book partially is to have expanded imaginations for moving into the future.
Yeah.
We have to keep in mind all the other forms of power.
Right.
And mm-hmm. the ways they're wielded.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, exactly. We do. Because if we let one yeah. go, if we let one of those escape or go unguarded yeah. or be unguarded again, yeah, then we're going to be up Schitt's Creek.
Further up Schitt's Creek. Yes. So there's one more example at the end of this chapter before we move on to chapter 9. And it's a pretty interesting site in China, actually, or a couple of sites. And before we get into what was found there or is found there, there is some context, which is that up until pretty recently, last few decades, I guess, again, this is a recurring time frame in the book.
Yeah.
Of when's the archaeology getting interesting, you know?
Right.
there was this idea that there was not much interesting or worth looking at in China archaeologically before the Shang dynasty, like 1200 BC.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And before that, it was more just kind of like boring Stone Age-y things or something.
It was all supposed to be the Neolithic
yeah.
in like a generic sense of
yeah.
like agricultural, but like village-y and
yes.
just kind of, yeah.
Which is not as interesting to the Davids and also maybe not as interesting in messing with the story that we have about how society develops, right?
Right, yeah. And also maybe not accurate.
Yeah. And turns out not very accurate because
right.
now they found some sites, I mean, that seem a lot like cities, or what we would mm-hmm. call cities that actually date back to 4,000 years ago, a couple thousand years BCE, that are closer up to the border of Mongolia, which is also because of different things having to do with historical factors of China, wasn't seen as an area of interest, so wasn't explored until the last few decades.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of urban sites there. The one that they want to pay more attention to, I don't know how to say this, I'm going to say Taosi, T-A-O-S-I. In that place, you see a pretty standard, or what has come to be known as standard, evolution of power in the urban setting. And so in the archaeological dig, you see power accumulating, there seems to be a decent amount of violence, there's shows of wealth, there is ritual violence, warring between factions, and conglomeration of power in general in the record, mm-hmm. archaeological record. But then at a certain point, maybe around...
Well, the earliest date that we get for Taosi is 2300 mm-hmm. BC,
mm-hmm.
but then it says that suddenly around 2000
oh,
BC,
right.
everything mm-hmm. changed.
Yeah, around 2000 BC, what you see is some sort of violent uprising, it looks like. There is an incredible amount of violence. The elite cemeteries are degraded. The corpses are treated violently in a celebratory way.
Mm-hmm.
And that there seems to be an overthrow of accumulated wealth and power. And a few hundred years follow of less accumulation of wealth, less evidence of violence, and an expansion of the city over time, which would imply an expansion of the population. And so what the Davids are arguing is this very well may be our first, at least the history of the first social uprising, the first social revolution.
At least in a urban context. Yeah. So maybe the first urban revolution.
Urban revolution was here.
That we know of. And it, I mean, it's kind of funny because they quote from the archaeologist, and that person is like, you know, the former palace area was razed and replaced with poor quality rammed earth dwellings.
Right.
And the city contained trash pits used by relatively low status people.
Right.
And they say the city clearly had lost its status as a capital and was in a state of anarchy. You know,
That's what the archaeologist says.
That's what the archaeologist is saying. Like, they're quoting from the archaeologist. So, you know, and they kind of are like, maybe we could read this in a different way.
Yeah, so what they're getting at is interpretation is really important.
Yeah.
And interpretation of the site, and also like what is, so anyone who's not going there, who's reading it through this lens only, the archaeologist lens only, is going to read a narrative that is one of good order and power and like things how they should be, status quo, opulence, and excellence going together that degraded into chaos and like some version of the Dark Ages.
He's kind of like, it became like one big trailer park.
Basically, something like that.
Or something. Like just a very poor, low wealth type of settlement.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's sad.
That's bad.
That's sad. Right.
Yeah. And he's like, it was unstable. Like, I mean, he gives this impression of a very like chaotic, unstable settlement. And they're like, well, I mean, there's no history. There's no more evidence of violence after the uprising. There's an expansion of housing, an expansion of land.
Yeah, the city actually got a little bigger during that time period in which it was like that. And it was like that for 500 years.
Right.
So they're like, it wasn't unstable.
Right.
It seemed like, yeah, people just kind of went about their business and had lives in a city without having overlords.
Right.
And yeah, maybe they didn't accumulate as many grave goods or gold and jades and stuff. But is that so bad?
Right.
Yeah.
So this is going to be important as we move forward and continue to look at other archaeological sites. And next, we will be moving to Mesoamerica.
That's right.
So now we're going to go to talk about a site, some urban ruins in Mesoamerica, Valley of Mexico.
We love urban ruins.
Yeah. We're not afraid of them.
No.
I found this part really fascinating. I knew little to nothing about the ancient city of Teotihuacan. And so I'm excited to talk about that now. And hopefully you all will be excited as well. But basically, but we don't know a ton about this place, but some of what we know came from the Mexica people who traveled through the Valley of Mexico around 1150 of this era. and they passed through these ruins and eventually moved on about a day's walk from the ruins and formed their city, Tenochtitlan, and partially modeled it on the ruins of Teotihuacan.
Right. Yeah. The Mexica people who most of us kind of know as the Aztecs.
The Aztecs. Yes. And people. Who would form the Triple Alliance later, which we're going to move forward in history to a story where they're much more prominent. But yes, the Teotihuacan heyday had been 8 centuries before the coming of the Mexica people. So the height of that city was a whole 800 years before this.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And the city, those ruins made such an impression on the Mexica people that they created a lot of lore and mythos and origin of the universe from that city. They mythologized the place into being a place of mountain pools and primal voids from which the planets sprang at the beginning of time. So they have this story about how the planets came up out of the pools in this mountain city and moved into the heavens.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
I mean, I'm obviously loving this part. But those planets were followed by gods.
I'd like to see Jupiter do that.
Yeah. Yes. Well, he's a big guy, it's true.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
But those planets were followed by gods who were followed by a race of fish people.
Right.
And the world had to be destroyed of the fish people to make room for ours. So that was sort of the origin story that the Mexica people created in response to experiencing those ruins. So they were clearly really intrigued by them and inspired by them.
Mm-hmm.
Not just to model their city, but also to tell their story.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the backstory there. At the time that Teotihuacan was prominent and expanding, there were maybe 1 million people scattered throughout that valley, which is helpful here too, because it's helping us understand the scale of population there, even if it wasn't densely packed.
Yeah.
Although they estimate there were maybe about 100,000 people dwelling within the city.
Yeah, some of these Mesoamerican cities have such huge populations compared to the ones in the rest of the world, like even the earliest, like this one. Yeah, 100,000 people.
Yes.
In the urban center, and then, you know, maybe 1 million in the valley in total. That's just amazing.
It is amazing. And what's also amazing and noteworthy is that though there is consensus with different theorists in this field or archaeologists, that there's evidence on like the number of people there, the time frame, but not there's no consensus on how the place was governed, but everyone agrees that it's weird and it doesn't really conform to expectation for the size. Because the sites around Teotihuacan have lots of evidence of kingship, they have evidence of accumulation of wealth. There's evidence of writing in most places around there that were of substantial size. But in Teotihuacan, there's very little writing, even though there are Mayan minorities and Zapotec minorities represented there in the ruins that you can see evidence of who had writing.
Oh, yeah. Teotihuacan follows the pattern of a cosmopolitan city where there's folks of lots of different cultures
that
lived there. Yeah, right. And one thing, I mean, I think is interesting just to note is that among the unknowns is whether Teotihuacan was like the capital of some broader empire or like anything. It's just not known.
It's not clearly,
but it's also not clearly is or whatever. It's really just not known.
Mm-hmm. And there's no ball court either. That was a standard feature of these cosmopolitan areas at the time. The ball game, you know, popular Mesoamerican and Amerindian.
It seems like it likely wasn't the capital of an empire. That's my humble opinion. But because like they talk about how it got started by people like fleeing seismic activity and volcanic eruptions and stuff. And they like people were on the move because of these, you know, like very non-political events.
Right.
And this is one place where people like gathered together in refuge from displacement due to earthquakes and volcanoes, and they just started all like living together here.
Right.
Yeah.
So to summarize, this is an urban area, pretty big and built out, that doesn't seem to have much writing. and doesn't have the ball court. There's also no great tombs. There's no like monumental tombs that we associate with big cities sometimes, you know. Yeah. But what there is a lot of is art. Even though there are a lot of people from different places who have come there together, mm-hmm. there is a recognizable art
right.
for the place.
Teotihuacan has an art style mm-hmm. of its own.
That's very noticeably different from yeah. the art around it.
Right.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so here they introduce this fascinating character who is a Hungarian-American art historian. Her name is Esther Pastori. And she published about this site and her findings and study of the place, sort of like the work that they're citing is late 1980s to 1990s. And she looked at their art and noticed how distinct it was and actually came to theorize a sort of conscious cultural inversion, which we might know from the David's schismogenesis here.
Right.
And she talked about how their art and culture differed from all those around them in that, though there were a lot of images, there were no images of domination. So the it's not just the art form, but what is represented uh-huh. that is really different for Teotihuacan.
Right.
And she talked about how the art rejected the depiction of the ruler and captive that you see in a lot of the art in the other areas of Mesoamerica. In art in other places, you'll see more glorification of aristocratic individuals, and you see none of that mm-hmm. in Teotihuacan. Mm-hmm. The art seemed to celebrate community and collective values. Mm-hmm. And so she was reading it not just as anti-dynastic, but actually as more of a utopian experiment. So you see here that the Davids would love Esther Pastori.
Yeah, they must have like really had a party when they discovered this.
Loved her yeah. work, right? Because she's saying these people define themselves in contrast to who's around them and celebrate their difference. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's really interesting. And before I get into the history of what happened there, I did want to read a description of their mural art because, wow, it's really something, unless you want to read it.
Streaming effigies emerge from clustered plant, human, and animal bodies, framed by figures with elaborate costumes, sometimes grasping hallucinogenic seeds and mushrooms. And among the crowd scenes, we find flower eaters with rainbows bursting from their heads.
Yeah, this is some culture here.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, so Esther Pastori is just like, yeah, they're in
there. These are paintings?
They're in, I think yeah. it's for, oh, it's paintings.
Right. Uh-huh.
She's like, they're onto some different stuff over here.
Right? It's murals. Yeah.
This is really different than the art around them.
Giveaways include dizzying color contrasts, fractal arrangements of organic forms that merge into one another, and intense geometrical patterning bordering on kaleidoscopic.
Right.
So, whatever clues that gives you.
But what's fascinating, I mean, to them, but also to me, about what you can see in the archaeological history of Teotihuacan is that there was a substantial change in how things were done there. And what I mean by that is when you're describing the
That led to what you're describing.
That led to what I'm describing. Yeah. So the what you were referring to, which is the people kind of gathering together uh-huh. from volcanic activity and other natural disasters or stressors.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just that gathering of people just led to utopia or something.
Right.
You know, in fact, the evidence shows that they were well on their way to a pretty entrenched hierarchy for quite a while, for the first few hundred years of their, mm-hmm. of the emergence of that city.
Yeah.
And what it looks like was happening is that people begin to settle there around year zero, and you see a lot of monumental architecture, including civic works, you know, like canals and mm-hmm. irrigation, all those kinds of things. But there's two large pyramids there. There's a pyramid of the sun and a pyramid of the moon. There's also a temple.
Which is what the Aztec called them.
That's what the Aztecs called them.
Yeah.
That's true.
But, just so, okay. you know, just
right.
to make, yeah.
That's right. We don't know what they
That's
actually
were.
That's
the names by which they're known now.
Right.
But it was, yeah, anyway.
And then there's a temple for the feathered serpent there as uh-huh. well.
And then there was like a kind of a famous road that connected yes. them.
But within this, there is all of this monumental architecture has evidence of ritual killing, human sacrifice alongside it. Mm-hmm. There's clearly movement of wealth up to a group of people, there is clearly hierarchy up to a certain point.
Yeah.
And then around 300 AD, the temple was desecrated and looted. There were no new pyramids built after that point. But there continued to be monumental architecture in the form of less of a monument than large-scale building projects. And in this large-scale building project that went on, they created housing. Good, spacious housing for over 100,000 city dwellers. They built it systematically over time, and there's some really cool maps in the book of the city and of these dwellings. They made apartment complexes that would have about 100 people each in them, and they did seem to be built upon the family as unit, whatever family means at that point. But then there would also be a central courtyard and ritual space in these apartment complexes.
Yeah.
And in all of them, there's evidence that there's plenty of food. There were some imports. Mm-hmm. They drank their share of pulque, which is a fermented beverage I've never been able to have, but Dave has had.
I have had. Yes, it's true. Made from the fermented sap of the agave.
Yeah, sounds delicious. Everyone I know who's had pulque just speaks so highly of that drink.
You know, this probably won't be for the tape, but you know how sometimes we turn to the audiobook reader for a clue as to how certain words and names are to be pronounced? Mm-hmm. I started to question that when he pronounced agave agave.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, wait a minute.
Right.
That's fair. Is maybe not to be trusted. But anyway, yeah, I thought this was fascinating too. If I remember right, in the earlier, more hierarchical stage of the city, we don't even have a great record of where most of the people lived, right?
Right.
Like, it's maybe implied that it's at least possible that, you know, the good quality building was the city center, the monuments, the ritual stuff, and maybe like the elites or something. And then the rest of people just lived in
shanty town.
Yeah, like a shanty or at least like biodegradable buildings that did not stand, you know,
shacks, whatever.
Yeah, that did not last for archaeologists to really find. But then, yeah, it starts to be converted to, they call it a social housing project. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it just seems very much like that, where it was, you know, a very well organized effort to construct high quality housing. Mm-hmm. That was not exactly cookie cutter, but, you know, but like uniform in the sense of like a uniform high quality standard to house tens of thousands of people at a relatively high level of comfort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like that.
Yeah.
What they want to draw attention to with this is that, you know, they looked like they were going, Teotihuacan looked like it was going in a very specific, very predictable direction. Accumulation of wealth, entrenchment of hierarchy, exploitation of environment, all of the things, you know.
Yeah.
And that at a certain point, things went otherwise. And they quit building pyramids. They quit being ritual sacrifice. There's very little evidence of violence after that point. Yet they kept up collaborative civic works of a large and grand scale, which is housing 100,000 people.
Right.
Which is no small feat, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I want to point out here, because they're not always, you know, the Davids are proud to often be standing against what people in the field think. In this case, there's pretty much consensus on there being a point in the history of this city in which things became less hierarchical and in which a long period of relatively peaceful collective living and building happened.
Yeah.
The consensus in the scholars,
it does seem like that, yeah,
seems to be similar to the Davids around this time. Now, what people take from that might be different, but they're going less against the conclusions drawn by the people on the ground here. You know, and I just think that's worth pointing out because it's not only an interesting example, and also I think there's consensus also about the fact that this culture is very different than the ones around them. So it's worth pointing that out just to say that this is not only a fascinating story in what it could be, it's a fascinating story in what it actually is accepted as. You know, we don't get that with all of the sites they talk about. You know, there's a lot of like, maybe we get to celebrate absence of evidence as a victory often.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But here there's actually evidence for at least relatively peace and a different use of resources to help the whole rather than a few.
Thank you. Now, for our last stop, we are actually going, we're kind of breaking with the pattern a little bit, because yes, this last thing is not actually about a very early city. Mm-hmm. It's about Tlaxcala, which they describe as an indigenous city-state in the country of Mexico, what we now call Mexico.
Right.
And Tlaxcala was home to a people who Cortez encountered, mm-hmm, the conquistador Hernan Cortez, as he was basically working up to attempting to overthrow the Aztecs,
right,
in their home city of Tenochtitlan. Mm-hmm. And so we're moving ahead to, what is this, 1519?
Something like that.
1519, mm-hmm, right? So we're going like more than 1,000 years in the future. We're not talking about early cities and, mm-hmm, them being egalitarian quite so much anymore, but we are talking about people doing democracy or something like it at scale, mm-hmm, in a place where conventional wisdom of the West, mm-hmm, does not usually teach us to look for it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Right. And, mm-hmm, the record here we're going to be looking at is not archaeological. It's mostly from correspondence or books written by Spaniards, often priests, mm-hmm, about this time period and about their encounters and what they saw.
Yeah.
And we're, for better or worse, we're very fortunate to have these records because it's a pretty interesting look at what happened at the time.
Yeah.
And
Tlaxcala is not, it's not an unknown place.
Right.
As far as history goes, like, that's not what we're trying to say. But there is, you know, for people who studied the Spanish conquest of Mexico, the people from Tlaxcala and Cortez and his men's encounter with them, and, you know, what we're about to tell is, like, that they eventually decided to go against the Aztecs, mm-hmm, with Cortez, mm-hmm, right? Like, they were part of, because Cortez could not take down the Aztec Empire without having all these indigenous allies.
Right.
And the Tlaxcala eventually became among those allies.
Right.
Or, you know, temporary allies of convenience or something. Yeah,
which became very inconvenient later.
Yeah, yes. Right. And all of that is well-known history, mm-hmm, but what is less known and, you know, according to the evidence that we're given here, a kind of misunderstood aspect of all of this is the actual nature of Tlaxcala society.
Right.
You know,
right,
so right, that's what is the object of study here.
Yeah. And I think part of what they're pointing out is that there's a tendency within the field for scholars or historians to just sort of use like king almost as shorthand or leaders as a shorthand, and they kind of shortchange the actual process on the ground, mm-hmm, and what, and which obfuscates the fact that there were many forms of governance happening,
yeah,
you know? And so they give many examples of that. We don't need to go into that, but there's some good ones in here, but they point to there being ample documentation of the absence of kings in Tlaxcala, because even Cortez's letters to the Holy Roman Emperor, who was Charles V, he's like, I can't find the people in charge to talk to. There's nobody in charge. I'm having trouble trying to make allies with these people because there's nobody who's a leader, you know?
Right.
And there's record of that, of his struggle for that. And what he finds over time is that there is group decision-making happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And before I get on to what that looks like, they do take a moment to talk about the reductive analysis of a sort of guns, germs, and steel framework. Uh-huh. If we're thinking about colonization, mm-hmm, you know, because they reiterate, yes, 1,000 Spaniards could not have taken Tenochtitlan,
right?
Even though they had microbes, even though they had, yeah, horses, even though they had weapons, you know,
right?
That without the cooperation of the people around the Triple Alliance, who were,
yeah,
not very happy about how they'd been treated for all those years.
Right.
Then this wouldn't have happened. There would not, they still, it doesn't mean there wouldn't have been eventually a conquest, possibly, but it, uh-huh, would have gone down like this.
Yeah, right. Right, 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 right. Yeah, because what they're saying is, like, if you're solely armed with just this guns, germs, and steel understanding,
yes,
of what determines the course of history, or at least the course of this history, colonization,
right, colonization, right,
then you would maybe not assume, mm-hmm, that Cortez had to have a lot of indigenous allies.
Absolutely.
In order to take down the Aztecs.
Right.
You would just be like, well, he's just fated to do it. Or,
right.
Yeah, right. You know, so this kind of complicates that story.
It does complicate,
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And he had to work hard to make make allies. And there was much deliberation, at least within the Tlaxcala people, mm-hmm, about this. There are several books that reference their processes and what society was like for those people, but one book that they find important that has not been spoken of very much in the history of this area is a book that's called Chronicle of New Spain, written by Friar Francisco Cervantes de Salazar. He worked on the Chronicle from 1558 to 1563. I mean, for those who are interested, if you want to follow up on this in the book, this sort of lost text that mm-hmm. has a lot to say about this group of people, mm-hmm. about this city-state, was found and contextualized by a woman named Zelda Maria Magdalena Natal, and she rescued this book from obscurity. So if you're interested in the secret heroes of history, she's one you might want to look into.
Yeah, like especially nerdy library types, because there's like true. Definitely kind of a goosebumpsy tale of intrigue and lost and found history that involves like finding a lost codex in mm-hmm. a library where yes. it had not been touched in, you know, hundreds of years mm-hmm. and all of this stuff too, that plays a part of this story, which, you know, kind of gave me the tingles.
Yeah, yeah. It's cool. She and Esther are heroes in this story, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, so in de Salazar's book, there are long parts that cover the governing council and how decisions are made and Lex Cala.
Yeah.
And the author describes lengthy argument and deliberation, lengthy consensus process. The council seemed to have been made, I mean, there's different debates around that, and this isn't just coming from his book, it's from other records, but their decision-making body was 50 to 200 people. People have different ideas about that.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that they talk about a little bit later in the chapter towards the end is that to become a council member, one had to undergo these fasts, deprivations, these humiliations to deserve to get to be a decision maker.
Oh yeah, that part is, you know, that's great. Yeah,
and I love that. Because there's an ordeal.
There's an ordeal
with deserving, with claiming
yeah.
the capacity or role of decision maker in the group of decision makers.
Right. It's not just even pledging allegiance to the flag or yeah. something. There's actually something more substantial you have to go through. Right.
So I don't know. That I loved reading that part, and it also reminded me of the what feels like 1,000 years ago episode now that you did on the anthropology of the Belize Mothers and Others,
mm-hmm.
and how in many cultures there are ordeals or different mm-hmm. humiliating feats that you have to go through
right.
to keep your ego at check, you know?
Yeah, right, right.
And that even on the scale of this giant city, like what you described,
yeah.
huge city-state,
yeah.
lots of people, there's still this intact, like, you know what, you need to bow down to be able to serve us, you know?
Yeah, right. You have to like crawl through the streets wearing a diaper.
Or something.
And everyone gets to see you do that.
Right.
You know, before you get to be part of the deliberative body that makes decisions.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost like hazing or something.
Maybe.
Anyway, maybe I'm letting my imagination run away yep. with me, but yeah.
Anyway, this is a group of folks who are making decisions here. There doesn't seem to have been any like election process, right? But there's a group of people who earn the right to be part of the deliberative body through going through ordeal. And then what we have in de Salazar's book is an account of the debate of whether or not to actually cooperate with Cortes,
mm-hmm.
which, whew, that was a decision that had a lot of impact on the future of the region and is still affecting the world today, right?
Yeah, and just to be clear about this one part, he wasn't there.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right? So he wasn't there to record
the debate. Oh, it was a grandson.
And it was like 40, 50 years after it happened or something, but
right.
he was able to talk to people who were there
right.
and get the story that way. I just wanted to be clear about that part, yeah.
Thanks for that, because I think that, if I remember correctly, without looking, he interviews the grandson of a statesman or speaker uh-huh. who actually, we're going to read a quote from what he said.
Right. Okay.
And we will get to it, but people who undermine his account, it has to do with the distance of time that had gone by from when it was written and think that he's projecting a lot of stuff onto these people. So we'll come back to that.
Oh, that he's projecting his own cultural yes. stuff or yes. whatever. Okay. Yeah.
But before that, do you want to read the quote from, this is from the debate about whether or not they should cooperate with Cortes against the Triple Alliance.
Yeah, there's a quote from the account that recounts what one member said in rebuttal mm-hmm. to someone who had just spoken. And the person who had just spoken was
advocating for allying with Cortez. Mm-hmm. And this person comes and says, does my comrade deem these people gods who seem more like ravenous monsters thrown up by the intemperate sea to blight us, gorging themselves on gold, silver, stones, and pearls, sleeping in their own clothes, and generally acting in the manner of those who would one day make cruel masters? There are barely enough chickens, rabbits, or cornfields in the entire land to feed their bottomless appetites, or those of their ravenous deer, what they called the Spanish horses. Why would we, who live without servitude and never acknowledged a king, spill our blood only to make ourselves into slaves?
He made a good point.
Yeah, that's a good speech.
It's a really good speech.
Yeah.
And also really good description of
I know it like people. I mean, I'll say that's maybe my, you know, wherever I got it from, similar to my impression of a Spanish conquistador too.
Right. Well, yeah, and cruel master would be the understatement of the eon, basically, with what ended up happening down there later.
Sleeps in their clothes.
Sleeps. Well, that part I love. I'm just like, oh, they didn't even take their clothes off to sleep.
Yeah. Or put on different clothes. Or
yeah, I guess, yeah. Or yeah. Anything. Yeah. They didn't bring pajamas?
Pajamas for the conquistadors.
So, as this, you know, if you haven't already made the connection, this reminds me of Candy Aronk, the debates that happened during that time, the kinds of talk that they had comparing cultures,
the eloquence,
and very convincing and apt brutal description of the colonizers we get from both kinds of testimony. But also the reaction to this text is really similar to the way people read accounts of Candy Aronk's speeches, because often de Salazar's work is considered, if it's considered at all, it's often just considered in relationship to other European texts, comparing them. Or people say he's projecting his own values onto the Tlaxcanos.
Right.
Which is absurd, because at the point that this was written and when this speech would have been happening, there was not democracy in Europe. There was not equal decision making. There was no idea of parliament. You know, so people are really projecting their own values onto the past and even onto Europe at that point, you know.
Yeah, right. Even the what the Davids recount in the early chapters about, you know, like the story of Adario and Candy Aronk and Lahontan and like all that stuff hadn't even been published yet.
No.
Right. So there wasn't time for, the Enlightenment wasn't really underway.
It was not
so
underway.
So what would be projected?
Yes.
I mean, you know, I would have to think about that more, but it doesn't seem to track.
It doesn't really track.
Yeah.
So there's also just this idea that they're pointing out once again the way that academia keeps us from actually examining written examples of collective process and sharing of power by undermining it with who's saying this anyway, or is this objective, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
just to say that that's happening again in the story.
Yeah, yeah, right. And I think they also talk about how there's a chauvinistic assumption that Athens is the origin of democracy.
Oh, sure. Right.
You know, basically.
Right. And that's part of the name of this chapter, actually.
Uh-huh. Oh, right.
Hiding in plain sight the indigenous origins of social housing and democracy in the Americas.
Got it. Yeah, yeah, right. Right,
yeah, because they're kind of like, what? No, you learned about this from them, you know?
Uh-huh.
Actually.
Right, yeah.
Or at least they were making you think about social organization in a new way that was confusing. But when looked back from the myth of Western democracy as the light shining the way for the world.
Right.
People need to retell that story.
They need to make it fit. Yeah.
They need to make it fit.
Right. Right. Exactly. And we should be clear that even though the quote that I read, the speaker was arguing against the alliance with Cortez, that the council would eventually decide to join with the Spanish in opposition to the Triple Alliance, to the Aztec Triple Alliance, you know, and some of that is played out here in the book too. Basically, somebody proposes a compromise where, what is it? They're going to say that they're going to ally with the Spanish, but then ambush them?
Yeah, and then if they lose, then they will join them?
Yeah.
And they do something like that.
Right, which Graeber thinks is like just a splendid example of the kind of compromise that emerges out of the type of assemblies that he's familiar with too.
Where you're like, you know, well, let's try where to do somebody, both things.
Yeah. Let's let's creatively, you know, do something that kind of takes a little from this and a little from this or whatever. So yeah, this is all very much music to Graeber's ears.
Yeah.
And very cool history to learn about.
It's really, really
and
nice.
And to hear, to hear these, even though they were reconstructed, you know, some decades later from interviews, just to hear it recounted in the form of a tale like this with the speeches being quoted is really nice.
It is. Mm-hmm. Oof. But the implications of the decisions made is tough.
Right. Yeah, it didn't go anywhere good.
No. Mm-hmm. Although for the people living under the Aztecs, that was not a good time either.
Right.
So before we leave off for this episode, I just wanted to share some thoughts I've been having around this whole idea of imaginary cities that we began with in the last episode, and the framing there, and then these examples of different ways of living that are in this chapter. Mm-hmm. And part of what I've been thinking about that they don't really get to is the way that there's sort of a denigration of the imaginary in our culture. Uh-huh. That imaginary means false or fantasy, fake. Kind of. Like, it's not real.
Right.
You know? Right. And they aren't saying that. They're saying, well, we kind of have to imagine these cities because they aren't here right now. Or all cities sort of work in the imagination because you never know everyone in the city. And you belong to something that's kind of itself not real.
Kind of abstract or something.
Abstract.
Yeah, it's definitely working on different levels. Because I think that they're winking at the fact that they are imagining the cities to be a certain way based on the evidence.
Right.
But also, they're trying to make their point that all cities begin in the mind, or however that's the first sentence.
And they have to be, and they exist in the mind at one level all of the time, even if there are civic works and monumental building projects and all of these things.
Yeah,
you
there's
know?
The idea of the city that you kind of have to have to be in one.
To have one, yeah.
Right.
So they're using imaginal in all of these ways, but I've also been thinking about imaginary as a word and the imaginal in the ways that have more to do with active creation, which would be, you know, what Dave already knows what I'm referring to. But I'm thinking of part of what comes out of the Sufi tradition with Ibn Arabi and that the French scholar Henri Corbin popularized. But also an idea that's very, that is common within a lot of magical lineages, which is that your imagination is very important for getting what you want in the world, for living in the world, for actualizing what you want to see.
Right.
And clearly this book exists partially to expand what we think is possible, to expand our imaginary capacity.
Yeah.
But I think part of the work that we have to do within that, or to be able to fulfill those that potential for the book, is to also stop distrusting imagination, to stop thinking what is imaginary is not real, and embrace that imagination is part of creation, imagination is part of world shaping and world building. And so as we have cracks put in the edifice of what we think is possible, we need to also be building and nourishing our capacity for imagining other. And creating other.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's just something that's been on my mind as we've been reading these chapters.
Yeah, I'm glad. It's cool that you brought in Corbin. And his word imaginal, if I remember right, he proposed that partially to get away from
imaginary.
You know, the trappings of this word imaginary. Because like imaginary can so easily mean it's in your head.
Right.
But the imaginal is a plane of reality.
Right.
There's a very crucial difference, you know, in the way it was conceived in the traditions that he details, you know, and is drawing from and have been drawn on, you know, by people since then, too, and expanded on. And I always, I like when I see somebody using that word imaginal, usually, not always. Sometimes they feel like an enemy, but
no kidding.
But just taking the imaginal seriously, taking the imaginal seriously as an aspect of the real that we can draw from and interact with and that we shape and that shapes us and that penetrates our world, the material world and everything very significantly too, and not just daydreams or like thoughts that are ephemeral.
Yeah. And I think that what the Davids are saying, whether or not they come out and say it because they are not as much tied into esoteric traditions, mm-hmm. is if we have to imagine the city anyway,
right?
Because the city requires imagination.
Yeah.
Then why not imagine a different city?
Uh-huh.
You know, and when we move through these other examples.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's so cool.
When we move through these other examples, I'm like, well, these people imagined a different city.
Mm-hmm.
In Teotihuacan, they were like, mm-hmm. we're not doing it that way.
Right.
We're doing something different.
Yeah.
And they stopped, not at the founding.
Uh-huh.
Once there was already hierarchy in place and monuments in place, they took a different turn and imagined something different and made it real through the imaginal.
Yeah, they imagined it into being.
Yes.
I mean, and, you know, it was more than just an act of imagination to put it into being, but it necessarily involves an act of imagination.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So before we move into the next part of the book, I just wanted to say, share some thoughts that I've been having as we read these two chapters.
Oh, I'm glad you did. The next chapter is a doozy. Why the state has no origin. This one, I think it might be the longest chapter in the book, page-wise. It is archaeological, anthropological, and also theoretical, because they have an extended case that they are making in the chapter, and we will tackle that next time.
All right.
Yeah.
Take care, everybody.
Yeah. Brace yourselves.